It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the classic summer place, Martha's Vineyard. The vacationer's fantasy? Stay. Move in. Well, our guest, vineyard native and local chef Tina Miller, talks about what it's really like, the people who make the island, how they live off the land and sea, and how a Renaissance turn of mind is essential. Well, the Stearns say Connecticut's great seasonal food, the hamburger, is in full flush at Clamps in New Milford. Our genius improviser, Sally Schneider, talks how to amortize my favorite summer treat, lobster. We check out San Francisco's Slanted Door, the first restaurant to put Vietnamese food in the city spotlight. And the queen of TelevisionWithoutPity.com takes on the Food Network, the good and the oh-so-bad. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's a vacationer's dream, eating and living year-round on Martha's Vineyard. The celebrities come and go, but the backbone of the island is its food people, the farmers, the hunters, and the fishermen. Vineyard native and local chef Tina Miller tells us their stories. Her book is Vineyard Harvest, A Year of Good Food on Martha's Vineyard. Well, my favorite improviser, food expert Sally Schneider, has the best idea for encoring that summer lobster. Just one recipe becomes a clutch of fabulous dishes. We go to San Francisco to talk to West Coast Chef of the Year Charles Phan about bucking the Chinese tide with his now legendary Vietnamese restaurant, The Slanted Door. Then Television Without Pity's Linda Holm critiques the Food Network. She picks and she pans. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's begin with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, you know, I'm remembering that you had this great find that was only open during herring season. It was cremated herring, and it was somewhere in the Carolinas. Any other seasonal finds like that?
Yes. When it's summertime in Connecticut, that means it's hamburger season.
Hamburger season in the summer.
This is when the hamburgers come up from the ground and wait their harvest.
No, during the non...
This is Michael's idea of agriculture.
Ripened on the grill. Yes, exactly.
During the non-R months of the year, Clamp's Hamburger Stand in New Milford, Connecticut opens up, and only during those months, to serve some of the most wonderful hamburgers in one of the greatest settings you'll ever find.
You know what I just love about Clamp's? Aside from the fact that for the first 10 years I heard about it, I thought it was cramps, but it's Clamp's with an L, it is a classic little restaurant with major attitude. Their business card says no sign, no address, no phone, just good food. So there.
That you said, I want to hear about the burgers, but you mentioned a great setting. What's the setting for this place?
Well, it's a grove by the side of Route 7. You know, Route 7 heading up north in Connecticut gets more and more rural as you go. And beyond the town of New Milford, it's really driving into the old-time countryside before there was any development. And you think, I've passed this place, because you're way out of town. And then by the side of the road is this grove of trees with picnic tables under the trees and this little tiny shack, which, as Jane said, has no sign, nothing to indicate that it's a restaurant at all, except for the fact that it's usually crowded with cars and people sitting at the picnic tables enjoying their hamburgers.
It is really a very pretty little place with good food. And Lynn, are you a fried onion fanatic? I don't mean onion rings.
Not deep fried.
But like... Yes. You know, sautéed till they're caramelized.
There is very little you can do to an onion that I will not scarf up.
Okay, well then this is the hamburger for you, because the hamburgers are very good. They're not spectacularly thick or gourmet burgers. They're nice kind of lunch counter hamburger patties. But what they do at Clamp's and what you have to have on your hamburger is what they call fried onions. These are what other people might call sautéed onions. Mm-hmm. But they're cooked until they're almost like a caramel relish that goes on top of the hamburger. And I personally like a lot of condiments on my mm-hmm. hamburger. In this case, I don't like any condiments but these onions. And they, with the hamburger on a nice plain bun, make a perfect summertime dish.
And to be honest, I could take the bun and the onions and be very happy.
Skip the meat.
Leave the hamburger somewhere else.
Is this a griddle burger, or is it on the barbecue grill, you know, burger? What's the style burger?
It's cooked on a flat, greasy old griddle.
It's not
like a slider, because sliders are very thin and greasy. This isn't that way. It's a little bit sort of thicker and richer than a slider would be. But what's great, one of the things about Clamp's is that it has been there since 1939, and I don't know for sure, but I suspect that the grill has been there that long too, because the hamburgers really have that kind of savor that you get when you cook it on an old piece of cast iron that you cannot get on a Teflon pan.
Sounds like summer to me. I'll give in. Ripened on the grill. Guys, thanks.
Bye, Lynn.
Happy burgers.
Ain't nothing like a big juicy burger. French fries and a shake. It's something like paradise. That burger they make. Make mine a double, onion rings on the side. Let's just break all the rules. Life is great, but we can't hesitate. I got them great big juicy burger blues.
Jane and Michael Stern have updated their classic guide, Road Food. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, while the Sterns are plucking up hamburgers at Clamps, I'm fixating on those caramelized onions. I mean, whenever you might use ketchup or a salsa or a chutney, use the onions. I mean, having a stash of caramelized onion in summer is like money in the bank. So here is my caramelized onion primer. Your bedrock is the unadorned onion. Slice it, dice it, wedge it. I don't care. But what you want to do is film a wide shallow pan with olive oil, heat it up to medium high, and pile in the onions. Salt and pepper to taste, because that draws out the sweet juices. And then once the onions start sizzling and browning, turn the heat down to medium-low, cover the onions, and cook them about 5 to 10 minutes. What you want is rich brown with lots of sweet flavor. Now, these are going to keep 10 days in the fridge, and they are great at room temperature on sandwiches and just about anything else. Now, you could add plums or peaches. You could add ginger. You could add chili. But the only rule of thumb for any variation is let the onions do the work. I mean, they're so delicious and they're so complex in flavor, you don't need much else. Crack cook and food writer Sally Schneider is a born improviser. Now, if you're ever stuck about what to do with an ingredient, go to Sally's book, A New Way to Cook. She's got great ideas and a healthy take on good food. Hey, Sally, welcome back.
Hi, Lynn. Good to be here.
Sally, I'd like to talk about something that's really luxurious, lobster. It's my big summer treat. How do you stretch it? Because it's pricey.
It's really pricey, but we cannot do without it, Lynn. And for my money, I just want to eat a whole lobster. I don't want to think about stretching the meat itself, because there's not that much of it in a regular lobster. But I hit on a way of amortizing my lobsters, that is, making them go over several meals and bringing the price way down by using the shells, which are really little gold mines of flavor, to make what I call a lobster essence, which is, in essence, a broth with a powerful lobster flavor. First of all, I don't want to scare you because it sounds like something that a chef would do. This is really easy. You can freeze the shells, first of all, so you can get to this whenever you want to. And the gist is you saute the shells, which brings out their flavor, with some leeks. You add some tomatoes and white wine and water and bay leaf and saffron, those kind of Provençal flavors, and you simmer it for an hour, and then you strain it. And that's it. And you end up from, say, two lobsters worth of shells, you get about 6 or 7 cups of this really intense broth.
So that's almost 2 quarts.
Almost 2 quarts, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's where we go to town, because you can use this fabulous essence to make all kinds of amazing dishes, even a couple of meals worth, I would say, easily. And you can freeze it. So if you freeze it in 2-cup containers, let's say, or quart containers, it makes it available to make some of the dishes I'm going to tell you about that I throw together at the drop of a hat.
So all the work's done in advance.
The work is done in advance. And the thing about the broth is all the flavors are built in. You're not going to have to struggle to build in flavors or even think about it much. At most, you might start by sauteing some shallot, and that's about it. So, but with some of them, all you have to do is reduce the broth to make it a little more concentrated, which I do for my lobster demi-tasse. Now, this is a rich cream essence of this lobster broth. I reduce the broth, add a little cream or creme fraiche, serve it in a demi-tasse cup as an appetizer for a lovely, beautiful meal or dinner party. And all I have to do to garnish it is snip a little bit of tarragon and chive on top.
It sounds great.
It is great, but you're not clobbering someone with a rich cream soup. You're giving them this essence of lobster, and they're going to think you worked forever on it.
What else?
Now, what else? I'm building steam because my favorite is a lobster paella. Now, I ate many paellas in Spain, and they can be quite a bit of work. But the gist is, with this, you sauté some shallot, sauté the rice, which is like an arborio rice, a rice
a medium
that's quite
grain.
Starchy.
Yeah.
Medium
yeah.
grain, exactly. And then you add the lobster broth, and you simmer it. And this is in a wide pan, not a deep pan, so that it will evaporate. The rice drinks up the broth. It creates a crust on the bottom of the pan, which is delicious, with the creamy rice in the center. And it is unbelievable. I have had friends say that it is better than actually eating a lobster itself. Now, I thought originally I would put shrimp or shellfish or whatever mm-hmm. in to embellish it. It doesn't need it. The only thing I've ever considered after that was a few slices of chorizo, which have a very interesting sort of counterpoint to the lobster.
It's a sausage, yeah.
Exactly. So from there, you can go to a risotto. You can do the same thing with fine noodles, and the noodles will drink up the broth and make a very silky pasta dish, which is incredible.
Mm.
And then there's a whole other realm, which is building fish and shellfish stews and soups out of this broth. So basically, you have the base. You will just plunk in mussels, clams, mm-hmm. shrimp, even chunks of a fish, and simmered in the broth. They, in turn, will give their flavor to the broth and even boost it further. And, you know, if you want to add roasted peppers or cooked potatoes, something like that, if you want to drizzle olive oil in, if you want to add cream and make it a creamy broth, I like it without cream, but serving an aioli on the side with some wonderful coarse bread. I can keep going.
Sally, this is, I think, a dynamite idea, and you can store it in the freezer. Hey, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Food Authority Sally Schneider is author of A New Way to Cook. Now, you can find Sally's recipe for lobster essence on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, go for some other great ideas. Sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, every week you get a quick weeknight supper recipe. This week, by the way, it's a two-for-one offer. Watermelon sweet basil rice salad and the cucumber soup of summer. And we always have shopping and technique tips, but best of all, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So sign up at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Living and Eating on Martha's Vineyard and Behind the Slanted Door in San Francisco. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our program is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. So often at this time of year, you vacation in a place, you fall in love with it, and you fantasize about living there. Martha's Vineyard may be the king of the heap. On the ferry back to the mainland, you always see people hunched over laptops tallying mortgage rates. 12 months a year in New England paradise. That's the dream. What most people don't know is the real life on the vineyard. The people, their work, their food. Chef Tina Miller tells the story of her home island in Vineyard Harvest, a year of good food on Martha's Vineyard. Hey, Tina, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You lucky girl, you. You live in paradise. How long have you been on the vineyard? How'd you come to be there?
I was actually born and raised here. So that would be 41 years, more or less.
What is the population of the vineyard? I mean, without the visitors.
About 20 to 25,000 in the dead of winter, and then high season, August, about 100,000. So
wow.
It's pretty extreme. Wow.
So, Tina, for you as a professional cook, I mean, is this a great place to be?
This is a great place to be, you know, with the intense, beautiful seasons. The sky's the limit here because we can grow so much, and we do have the ocean, which is just endless.
You know, the thing that I think people don't realize, Martha's Vineyard's in New England, off the New England coast. I had never thought of it as a farming community until I read your book.
Absolutely. You know, 100 years ago, this island was covered with sheep and cattle. This has always been a farming community and a fishing community. It's really diverse in that sense. And in fact, the town that I live in, West Tisbury, was separated from Tisbury because it was a farming community and Tisbury was on the water and they had different interests. So there's always been a real strong farming community. And I would say in the last 10 years, it's really come back even stronger, which is great for us who live here.
You know, it's always thought of as being, especially lately, this celebrity-oriented place. But when everybody is gone, you're down to the real community. I mean, you write so much in the book about the artisans, about the food producers.
Yeah, there's definitely, I mean, there's a lot of Renaissance people. I mean, this is not a regular place to live because we have 90 days of high season where you can make a really good living. And then not much in the winter, so everybody's creative. And if you moved here and you are, like my husband was a drummer in L.A., now he's an electrician. So everybody's got sort of several titles here. Scott Terry, who I mentioned in the book, who's a bass fisherman, is also a fantastic painter and hunts in the fall. And so there's a lot of people like that.
Tell me about Scott. He's one of the people you do talk about who supplies you with food.
Yeah, Scott Terry caught one of the biggest bass ever on Martha's Vineyard. And I used to buy bass from him and the most beautiful, incredible quality, and I needed to know why. And so I went fishing with him about four or five times, and it was unbelievable to just watch a master pulling up these giant, you know, 20, 30-pound bass. And, you know, he'll bring in 40 a day during commercial season. And then in the fall, he's out hunting for deer and then in the winter he paints and he sells all his paintings at a gallery here. So true Renaissance.
Yeah.
You know, everybody works their tails off and somehow it keeps going.
You know, it seems like there's a double-edged sword here that all of these small businesses need that influx of the 75,000. And yet, do those 75,000 visitors and the image that's developed of Martha's Vineyard, has that changed the life there in negative ways?
I don't think so. You know, I grew up here in the 70s and it was very poor. And I think the diversity that the vineyard has now is great for all of us because we can make a decent living here now. And, you know, we have a really nice, diverse population. You spoke about the celebrities, but it's not celebrities. It's, you know, six very different towns with different histories. Oak Bluffs, for instance, has been one of the biggest African-American resorts for 100 years. And, you know, we have one of the recognized tribes in Massachusetts, the Wampanoag tribe in Aquinnah. You know, so all the towns are very different and very diverse, and it brings a really interesting population who really just love this place.
What's the best time to come as a visitor?
Fall, no question. We have such a cold spring. It was in the 40s still in June, you know, some days. But yeah, I mean, it was
and the
like,
water's like ice, right?
The water's freezing. Yeah, if the water doesn't warm up, the island doesn't warm up. But when it does warm up, it stays warm well into the fall. So, you know, you can get corn in late October here, and it's just gorgeous. It's golden. You know, the beaches are open. There's enough people here to have enough businesses still open and good restaurants. And it's just, you know, a beautiful time to hike around the island.
It sounds like you said Renaissance people, these people as individuals. But it sounds like the island has gone through an incredible Renaissance, drawing so many people into
Absolutely.
The life there.
Yeah. I mean, this is a place you don't, you may have visited and it gets under your skin, but you really have to work to live here. You have to choose to live here. You don't just land here, because it is a tricky place to live because of the intense seasons. You know, of you've got to be creative to make it work here.
Well, Tina Miller, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Lynn.
Tina Miller is author of Vineyard Harvest, A Year of Good Food on Martha's Vineyard. Now, Tina left us with a recipe that says New England all over it. Lobster and sweet corn fritters with red onion cocktail sauce. Find it on the website, guys, splendidtable.org. Oh, God, I'm so hungry for that. I've been hearing raves about the Slanted Door restaurant in San Francisco for years. Chef Charles Fan and his family took a flyer, a Vietnamese restaurant in a Chinese town. They started a tiny place in the downright dangerous neighborhood. Financing was credit cards, and the food was not what you'd expect. The city loved it. Well, a decade later, the Slanted Door is still the darling of San Francisco critics, but now it's ensconced in the sleek Ferry Building. It serves nearly 1,000 meals a day, and Chef Charles Fan was named this year's best chef on the West Coast. Well, we visited the restaurant just as lunch was dying down. Customers were lingering over the last sips of wine and coffee. The wait staff was beginning to dig into the staff meal. Chef Charles Fan looks 18 in his chef whites. One of his young sons is tooling around the restaurant, missing school today with a stomach ache. A bad piece of sushi at a Japanese restaurant last night, Charles says with a grin. Well, even with the highly designed interior, the Slanted Door is a family place. We sit down with Charles and his mother, Quyen Phan.
Quyen and Charles, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. How did the family come to America?
1975, we got on a boat and left South Vietnam. And we basically were boat people, and drifted and end up in Guam, and stay in Guam till 1977.
So you came here then in 1977 to San Francisco?
Yeah.
Charles, from what I understand, you did not train to be a chef. You were training to be an architect?
Yes. I want to be a potter, actually. But
really?
But Dad wanted us to do something more professional, so I decided to do architecture.
So how did the Slanted Door begin?
Well, we came here. Mom got a job in the sewing shop. Dad got a job as a janitor for an English pub. Uh-huh. So by 1978, I got a job busing table and pretty much in the restaurant scene since then. And I think what I learned from the parents is they're emergent. They really don't want to work for somebody else, so they're constantly looking ways to open a business. So by 1982, they opened up a sewing shop, and I left school and ended up doing the sewing shop for a little while, mm-hmm. and then tried to design mm-hmm. clothes, and that wasn't me, and went to work selling software for a couple of years. That wasn't me either. So finally, I decided to open a restaurant. I just saw this niche that no one was doing, sort of find a service with Vietnamese cuisine, and also the Vietnamese cuisine was missing on the San Francisco landscape.
Well, now, Quyen, what did you think when he said he wanted to open a restaurant?
First time he said he wanted to open that restaurant, I was very surprised, because I think my son do restaurant. He said, yeah, I try. Mom, do you help? I said, yeah, of course I help.
So how did this begin? Because now this is one of the most famous Vietnamese restaurants in the country, and you opened, I understand, very small.
You know, I had this idea for 10 years in my head, you know, like the whole Asian American experience, and we decided to just kind of wing it. But it really, seeing Chez Panisse, it really gave me the impetus to say, you can open a restaurant with 6 items on the menu and be okay.
Is that what you had, 6 items?
Yeah, 6 items.
What were they? What were the 6?
I think it was like a spring roll and a catfish clay pot and a salad and a meat dish. And, you know, and we didn't, I wasn't a professional cook. I cook a lot at home, but, you know, but it's not something I have a lot of confidence about. But seeing Chez Panisse, seeing Zuni, and I remember being in Zuni and saying, oh, they got bad salt and pepper shaker. I would have a little bit better looking one than that. I just keep seeing all these missing parts to this restaurant equation. You know, nobody was serving spring roll, nobody was serving crepe. And we would eat all this food at home, and nowhere else in San Francisco was they're making it.
Now, your spring rolls, though, they're not like any other spring rolls I've had. They have ingredients in them that... why don't you describe these?
Spring roll is traditional. They call it summer roll. Spring roll, they are made with fresh rice paper, with lettuce, mint, and shrimp, and pork. And usually have a sauce, a peanut sauce, or hoisin sauce. In our recipe, mom recipe, there's aioli, fresh aioli.
That's the garlic mayonnaise from France?
Yeah. And we have a peanut sauce that our signature peanut sauce, which had miso paste in it.
And that's Japanese?
That's Japanese. So mom learned how to make aioli when she was working in a French hospital in Vietnam.
That makes sense. But how did the miso get into the recipe? Tapping the forehead.
Well,
yes, all right.
You know, she was working in the sewing shop, and they would get off, you know, 4 o'clock on the bus stop, and people would share cooking story, and they're talking, and she was playing around with miso. She added the miso into the peanut sauce. Although it's not a secret anymore because I gave everything away.
Kuyen, do you still cook for the family?
Yes.
And do you do this every day, or
no,
is it?
If I want to cook, I tell my kid, tonight come home to eat, mom cook for you.
She cooked 4 nights a week minimum. Our brother still has a sewing shop. It's 2 houses down. So she cooked lunch for these guys every day, 5 days a week.
So you've got a lunch service going, Kuyen.
Yeah.
I understand that this is really a family business. I heard 20 members of the family work at the Slanted Door.
I have 22 now, I think, at the latest count, that they're actually blood related. But a lot of our key member staff, like Justine, she, you know, 5'9", blonde. She's been here since 6 months after I opened, and she's family too. And a good part of our kitchen crew, you know, half my wok cooks are dishwasher with me, you know, 9-10 years ago. And now these are my leading wok cook. So, very big family.
Kuyen and Charles, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Slanted Door restaurant is in the Ferry Building in San Francisco. You want to know how far America's food obsession has come? Well, I wish I had a dollar for every person who's told me they love the Food Channel. Sometimes it's confessional style. No one should know. But most of the time, it's more soap opera style. People dying to gossip about what Emeril said and about what Rachel's eating. Well, with all this adoration, I thought it would be fun to get the take of a person who makes their living critiquing TV shows and who is not a food crazy. Media critic Linda Holmes is the queen of televisionwithoutpity.com. Linda, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, Linda, you watch TV for a living, all right? Why are people so fascinated by the Food Network?
I think people are fascinated by it for a couple of different reasons. There are people who watch the Food Network for actual instructional content.
Mm-hmm.
There are also people who watch it for the same reason they watch a lot of other things on television, which are silliness, train wreck quality, pure yeah. entertainment, and sometimes just... astonishment at what you can find on television on any channel, that channel as much as any other.
Well, it's almost like, I think you could say it's probably one of the pioneers in reality TV in a funny way.
That's very true. I mean, I think reality TV has become a bit of a meaningless phrase because it's not clear exactly what it includes.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly any definition of it has to include the instructional shows and documentary shows and things like that that have been around since long before there was any such thing as Survivor or
right.
anything like that. So I think you're absolutely right.
Okay, from a critic's point of view, which are the shows that really get your critiquing antenna going? Which are the ones that make you nuts?
The ones that make me nuts, I think the first one that comes to mind is a show they have called Semi-Homemade Cooking with Sandra Lee. And that show, the idea is supposed to be upscale, fast, and easy cooking. The look of the show is very gauzy, and she looks a bit like a Barbie doll, and she's very perky, and the appliances are gleaming, but she cooks like a college student. And the recipes almost always include a ton of prepared foods, almost on principle.
Uh-huh.
And, for example, if she's got a recipe for a cake, right, on a really ambitious day, she'll start you out with cake mix. Okay. On a less ambitious day, she'll start you off with a cake. Go buy a cake.
All right.
That'll be the
all
first
right
step. Uh-huh. And then the recipe will consist of just pouring something over it or putting something next to it, you know?
Uh-huh.
And it's not always clear how useful that advice is going to be. I watched her make funnel cakes the other day out of...
Oh, those are the deep fried...
Right. Yeah. And the batter that she made was made from primarily Bisquick and artificial vanilla coffee creamer. And it sort of occurs to you that if you're so busy,
yeah,
that you can't pour the milk and the vanilla and you have to go for the creamer,
yeah,
maybe that's not a day to deep fry your own funnel cakes. It's possible.
I have to confess, the idea of the coffee creamer does sort of throw one off, doesn't it?
It sounds revolting to me.
Thank you. Yes.
I think there's no, you know, there's no other.
Uh-huh.
But so that's sort of one thing I think is a bit of a failure for them. They also have relatively recently launched an American version of Iron Chef. And Iron Chef was really one of the shows that originally put Food Network on the map for a lot of people. It was a Japanese import, and the dialogue was dubbed in English, which sort of gave it a bit of an otherworldly quality, just the bad dubbing.
Right.
And
right,
a lot of the food was also very unfamiliar to audiences of the Food Network. Don't get a lot of asparagus ice cream in this neck of the woods. But the current version is essentially devoid of irony. And as a straight up show, it falls quite flat. It's just a bunch of cooks cooking.
These are the Food Network stars in
right
competition with other chefs.
Right.
The thing about Iron Chef that made it so compelling was it was so over the top, and yet there was an element of it that said, we take this seriously. And then you saw some real talent. But for us looking into another culture, I think it was just fascinating. It was so maybe looking
absolutely
into our culture isn't anywhere near as interesting.
I think that's right. And a lot of the Iron Chef stuff was spectacle. My mother confessed to me the other day that when she cooks in the kitchen, she sometimes finds that if she's been watching Iron Chef, she flourishes a little more with the knife. It was all very flashy and a lot of fun. And as a straight up show that bears a lot of resemblance to everything else they're doing, it doesn't hold up very well.
All right. What do you like?
They have a couple of excellent shows. My personal favorite is probably Good Eats, which is a show that's hosted by Alton Brown. And he is a lot of fun to watch. It's sort of like taking cooking from one of those really wonderful, slightly unhinged high school science teachers that everyone had one of.
Yes.
And
yeah,
his goal is always for you to understand why you're doing everything. He doesn't want to just tell you, put in this, put in that, don't do this. He wants you to understand why you're adding salt or why you're not adding salt or why it's important not to touch it too much or do this or do that to it. And in that sense, it's the best kind of instructional TV because it's very entertaining, but it's also very useful. He also has a tendency to throw in a lot of corny skit night kinds of things, finger puppets and animations and silly costumes and little
mm-hmm
vignettes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's fun in that sense. It's a little silly, but it's also got a lot of content to it, though.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What else?
I also like very much a show with Paula Deen called Paula's Home Cooking. And she's their Savannah-based Southern cook. And she's a wonderfully warm, engaging presence, but she brings her dogs on the show and her sons on the show. And she's
mm-hmm
so friendly and she loves you so much. But what's really fascinating about her is that in an environment where you can turn on sort of any channel any day and see people fretting very understandably about the sugar and fat content of everything, Paula Deen's love affairs with butter and mayonnaise and brown sugar have been completely unaffected. She's untouched by that. And it is food not for the faint of heart, either
literally,
figuratively, or
yes,
right, or cardiology wise. But it's sort of fascinating to watch on the Food Network. You've got the low carb guy haranguing very earnestly about watching the amount of red onion that you put in because it has carbs in it. And then you watch Paula making bread pudding out of 2 dozen Krispy Kreme donuts and a 1 pound box of confectioner sugar. So she's a lot of fun. Just she's a rebel in that sense.
Ah, yes, and the new season is just around the corner. Linda, thank you.
Thank you.
Media critic Linda Holmes writes for TelevisionWithoutPity.com. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge, and it was inspired by that slanted door interview. The question is, what is the newest take on takeout? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at Target.com/Super Target. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the newest take on takeout? Well, the answer is making us the kitchen stars. Now, this is the anti-passive takeout movement. Anybody can cook. You pick up a pre-prepped bag of ingredients, a recipe, and you cook it. Now, it started out with Rocket Meals in London, kiosks where you could pick your dinner. Kung Po chicken, pasta carbonara. Each meal is a kit, and inside is everything you need for the dish, pre-cut and measured. The instructions are easy enough for a five-year-old, and cooking time is 10 minutes. Well, Rocket Meals and spin-offs have spread throughout England. Now the Slanted Door restaurant in San Francisco has opened its own kiosk, Out the Door. Now they're doing the same thing with their most popular dishes. Now, I'll bet this is going to spread like wildfire. Why? Because chef worship has us all yearning for a star moment at dinner. And Rocket Kits give us our very own place in the sun. Next stop, the Food Network. The lines are officially open, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Melinda on the phone from Cortland, New York. Hey, Melinda, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I just recently received a jar of capers as a gift, and I'm not quite sure what they are or what to do with them, and also their shelf life and how to store them.
Ah, okay. Tell me, are they in liquid or do they look like they're packed in salt?
They are in liquid.
They are in liquid. Are they very tiny?
Yeah.
They're very tiny. Okay. You have one of the oldest condiments coming out of the Mediterranean.
Cool. Capers
are the unopened flower bud of a bush. And in fact, when they actually come to a flower, the flower looks like a white orchid that has a deep magenta center. It's utterly gorgeous. So what you have is gorgeousness hiding inside of those little green beads.
That's great.
Now, essentially, because they're salted and then they're packed in vinegar, and that's probably what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, I mean, if you want to get really basic about it, almost anywhere you put salt, you could put a caper. Mm-hmm. But it has a nice herbal, fruity quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
Think about this, okay? Tomatoes sprinkled. I would drain the caper. You know, just take whatever you want from the jar and rinse it very lightly.
Okay.
Sprinkle it over sliced summer tomatoes that you've also put some olive oil and black pepper on.
be fabulous, absolutely wonderful. There is, capers are always part of Provence blends of things like tomatoes and black olives and anchovies and then onion and lemon. And by the way, capers and lemon zest, you can rub that and a little garlic, rub that into any meat or fish or poultry and then slow grill it.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it's fabulous. And it's capers and fish are one of the great classic combinations. So you don't need a lot. I mean, you'd use at most a teaspoon or a tablespoon of them.
Okay.
And you could heap it a bit. But think of them as a salty, fruity, herbal condiment.
Okay, and they do need to be refrigerated.
Once you open them, yeah. And I'd say keep them covered in vinegar.
Okay.
And that way they'll last, and they should last 6 months in the fridge.
Oh, great.
I mean, in the vinegar, they're really not going to go bad. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're kind of, they last forever. And then when you get done with that jar, you may want to experiment with salted capers, which you'll find in some gourmet shops.
Okay.
And those you can use straight as they are, but they're also great when you rinse them or let them, just put them in a, you know, a coffee cup with a little bit of water,
okay,
cold water. And then you really get that flower, fruity kind of herbal taste. And they're really great. And there's big ones and there's little ones.
Okay.
And yeah, and you can really fool around. The bigger they are, the more flavor that you get from them.
Mm-hmm.
So try that. See what you think.
Great. I love your show. Love the theme song.
Thank you so much. I'll tell Billy Barber. Billy Barber is the person who composed the theme song.
It's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Okay. Take care, Melinda.
Bye-bye.
Guys, you can reach us 800-537-5252. We have got Eden calling from Carbondale, Colorado. Eden, welcome.
Thank you.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, we love your show.
Thank you.
Our Sunday afternoon ritual is to sit down with a cocktail and a little nosh and listen at 4 o'clock. And
that sounds pretty great.
It's pretty great. And, you know, normally we do a nice glass of wine or something, but we sometimes like to sip a little single malt scotch. And we have noticed that we haven't really found much food that tastes very good with scotch, and I wondered if there was anything.
Oh, that's a great. You know, that's a good question.
It's a really strong flavor, and we love it, but you know, we're not sure what to eat with it.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'd try bittersweet chocolate.
Oh.
You know, especially if you got some of the really smoky, rich ones.
Right. Yeah.
I think a little bittersweet chocolate that maybe has a little cream blended into it, you know, like a truffle.
Yeah. Right.
Not too sweet.
Right.
I think that would be interesting. The other thing, you know, it'd be nice to do is to buy good salted almonds. I get mine at a co-op.
Uh-huh.
And I'd re-roast them with a little olive oil, or you could just start out with whole almonds. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And roast them in a slow oven with a bit of olive oil, coarse salt, black pepper, and maybe something like ground cumin or a little allspice.
Mm.
You see, these sort of enriching round flavors.
Right.
And the nuttiness of that nut with that bit of spice and the crunch of the coarse salt. I think that would really be nice with something like a single malt.
Yeah, yeah. And we were wondering, too, there's, you know, anything from Oban that's really smooth and kind of clean to the Lafroy, which is really smoky and strong.
And the Lafroy is where I would think along the lines of something like the chocolate.
Ah, okay.
And, you know, rather than go to the effort of even buying a truffle, you could just buy one of those really high-end candy bars where there's good bittersweet chocolate, but there's something creamy in the middle of it. And just see. And there is, to me, listening to the Splendid Table with a Lafroy and a candy bar, hey, I could do this.
What could be better, yeah.
But I think, you know, the single malt scotches, everybody says, oh, you drink them after dinner and all that. Uh-huh. But, you know, the other thing I remember liking a lot with them was certain pâtés.
Oh, I don't think we've tried that. Yeah.
Something that's, again, rich, creamy in feeling. But when you get into the sterner single malts, I wonder about doing something in a cheese. Like, for instance, I wonder what would happen if you did a medium or a sharp cheddar.
Huh.
I'm speculating out loud. I'm not sure. But I think the idea of maybe take the two extremes in the scotch, okay?
Uh-huh.
And I'd say lay out a little, you know, a nibble of cheddar, a nibble of chocolate, that kind of thing. And just take a taste and see what you think.
Yeah, it would be fun. Yeah.
I mean, blue cheese might even work. It's not my favorite with scotch, but it could do it.
You never know, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But just remember how big and mouth-filling some of these can be.
Right.
Think of that as the food you want as well.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Hey, thanks by the way, are you in Carbondale as in near Aspen?
Yes.
As in a Mexican restaurant that's really run, I think, by a Colombian family that has the most incredible sandwiches and stuff?
I wonder if you mean El Carita?
I think so. It's right on the edge of town.
Yeah. Oh, actually, no, you're thinking of, we have a lot, we have a nice Hispanic community with lots of good restaurants as a result. You might be thinking of Garcia's.
Maybe that's it. Yeah. Oh, I stopped there. I'm leaving the Aspen Food and Wine thing. And, you know, I could have moved into Carbondale.
Yeah, Carbondale.
You are
great.
So lucky, girl.
I know.
Hey, enjoy the scotch.
I will. Thanks so much, Lynn.
Thank you. Bye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. I like that. You know, single malt scotch and a candy bar and listen to the show? Not a bad idea. Okay, who's up next? We have Tom calling from Tullahoma, Tennessee. Tom, hi, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I have a question about some kitchen gadgets.
Okay.
You were close, but it's Tullahoma.
Tullahoma.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Doesn't offend me any. I have a friend that loves to cook, and he loves his kitchen, and everything is just so.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to buy him a gift for his birthday. Nothing real big or expensive, or just a,
something.
Just a simple gadget, something new that's just been out, or something you might walk by and say, "Oh, I don't really need that. I've already got something that does that." You know.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, because he's someone, obviously, who loves to cook, has a lot of good stuff. You know, one thing, he may have it, but you can always have another one. They're called microplanes, and what they are essentially graters, and they come in different degrees of fineness. They usually have a handle, and then there's a sort of a plate of metal. It may be curved, and it has holes punched in it. You know, it looks like a cheese grater. You know those standing box cheese graters?
Yeah.
Just imagine somebody taking one side of that, cutting it down, and putting a handle on it. But they come in all different sizes, and they're a big deal now. Everybody wants to have a collection of them. And they're maybe $5-$10. You know, they're not a lot of money. You know, the other thing that I know this sounds really mundane, but most people don't think about these things. There is a kind of spatula that looks almost like a spoon. And it's the best thing in the whole world when you're scraping anything out, because it not only acts as a rubber spatula, you know, where it gets right against the side of the bowl or the pan, but because it's slightly cupped, it's great. It picks up things. But all of the really fancy ones that are very expensive are terrible. The lips on them fold back and they're wimpy. Rubbermaid makes the very best of these spoon-like spatulas. And they're inexpensive, and I would get him a small one, a medium one, and a big one. And he will kiss the hem of your pants, of your slacks, because they're dynamite. It's a great, great collection of tools. Do three of them, and they'll be maybe $15.
Good idea.
Hey, you take care. Bye. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Let's see. We have Cheryl up next. She's calling from Guilford, Vermont. Hey, Cheryl, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'd like to talk about making gnocchi. A couple of weeks ago when the weather was cooler, I found this really delicious-sounding recipe for sweet potato gnocchi with brown butter and sage. And it called for about 1.5 pounds of sweet potato,
right,
cut up and boiled, and then add to, about 1.5 cups of flour and an egg yolk. And so I followed the directions, and the mixture was so mushy and soft, mm-hmm, I had to keep dumping in more flour and more flour to try to get something that I could form into those little gnocchi shapes. And my first thought was, well, it's a bad recipe, because I'm a pretty decent cook. But I checked other recipes, and a couple other ones for both sweet potato and regular potato gnocchi, and those called for about the same proportion. So I was wondering if you could give me any sort of visual or tactile tips or any kind of clues about what I might need to do to make it a firmer gnocchi.
I have to tell you, my argument is I think it is a bad recipe.
Okay.
And this is why. Sweet potatoes or yams are very moist to begin with, moister than the kind of potato you would normally use. You know, normally you use like an Idaho Baker, a russet potato,
okay,
a drier, starchy, fluffy potato to make gnocchi, because you don't want it to be wet.
Right.
You would never use a boiling potato. And
even though some people boil those potatoes, I think they are best baked, slit baked, so more steam escapes and then scraped out of the skin. Now, if you boil a sweet potato, which is already moist, you know, you're creating sop heaven.
Yeah.
So personally, it annoys me. Someone, you know, had you waste your time because they wrote a recipe carelessly. So what I think might make sense, and I'm doing an educated guess, split them in half and bake them in the oven. Because that'll help, you know, do a slow bake, 350, even 400. Mm-hmm. Put them on a piece of foil because they're going to ooze a little. But that'll help dry them out. And then I think what might be a great idea is you'll use, let's say, for a pound of the sweet potatoes, about a cup of flour, about two eggs. And, you know, the flour goes in last.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because otherwise, if you beat the flour, work the flour too much, it gets to be kind of tough.
It was gluey, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So what you want to do is two eggs, which are part of the glue, these potatoes that you have cooled completely, never covered, you want to, you know, scrape them out of the skin.
Right.
And you know what I would do to add more good-tasting glue? I would throw in a cup and a half or so of freshly grated Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese and salt. So let's just, off the top of the head, 1 to 1.5 pounds of the split baked potatoes, about a cup of flour. Well, first start with the potatoes, then add two eggs, stir in the cheese, then work in about a cup of flour, salt, pepper, maybe a little nutmeg, and see how that works for you.
And it should be firm enough to form without leaving half of it on your hands.
Yes, and you flour your hands for this baby.
Oh, okay.
And you make like almost think like making little tiny hamburgers. You know, you want it to be a half inch thick, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not going to be the round, you know, because you just don't have the same structure to this as you have with a potato gnocchi, where you can make it into little ovals and rolls very easily.
Right.
And consider yourself happy and very fortunate when this all comes together.
Okay.
But I think the key is never boil up, you know, the potato for something like this.
Right. That's great advice.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's going to be delicious.
Well, the I made it anyway. The flavors were good, but they were ugly little things. But the
nasty
flavors were wonderful. So I will try again.
Okay.
Okay.
Enjoy.
Thank you.
You take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Jay Leno. He said, "Have you looked around? Most Americans are the food pyramid. Small at the top, wide at the bottom." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, you know, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.